I'm sitting here with Kai Ida, former special representative of the Secretary General in Afghanistan and author of Power Struggle Over Afghanistan, an inside look at what went wrong and what we can do to repair the damage. Welcome to the Global Observatory today.
Thank you.
Ambassador Ida, in your book, you write that Karzai sometimes claims that the big corruption is caused by the international community, and that Afghan corruption is merely petty corruption. You comment that Karzai's claim is not true. What do you see as the sources of corruption and the impact corruption is having on Afghanistan?
Well, I think that from the Afghan side also, there's more than petty corruption. Certainly, there are people engaged in corruption at a large scale. And of course, what we've seen over the last few years is that corruption, in fact, has grown. They have not been able to handle it the way they should and haven't done enough, certainly. But let me add to that, there are several sources of corruption. And of course, what you see coming into the country of foreign assistance plays an important role here, because I don't think we have, the donors, and I don't think the Afghans have, certainly, the right kind of mechanisms of control and accountability. So money disappears to district governors, province governors, and to others on the way, unfortunately. Then let me also add that Karzai believes that when he sees a person coming in, a technical advisor from abroad with a salary of $500,000 to $600,000 a year, then he believes that that is corruption. Of course, we would not say this, but he believes it's corruption. And he sees, and the Afghans see, that kind of behavior from the international community, and it angers them. I have many examples of this. And for them, as I say, it is corruption. Petty corruption is, of course, when you have a provincial governor or a police chief charge $10 for a stamp on a document. Is that petty corruption? Well, in a way. But if you earn $60 a month, then it is not petty corruption. And it also angers the Afghan people.
Current NATO, the International Security Assistance Force's strategy, is often referred to as fight, talk, build. Do you think that strategy can work?
Well, I'm pleased to see that those are the three words that we now focus on, because before it was clear, hold, build. Now we talk more about fight, talk, build. So the talk has recently come into the equation, and that to me is tremendously important. What we have seen over the last 2 years is a gradual shift in the views of the international community, where now there is a readiness to talk from almost all quarters. That is relatively new. When I came in 2008, we were almost alone to say that the political bargain had to be struck, and that also you have to talk to the leaders of the insurgency. Now I think most of us believe that's true, and I think it's the only way to go. This will not be solved in any way with military means. It will be solved in the end through a political solution.
During your tenure from 2008 to 2010, you initiated outreach to the Taliban. You write about working to identify steps to de-escalate the violence and mentioning confidence-building measures, including the consideration of ceasefire arrangements. What would you suggest for confidence-building measures today?
Well, unfortunately, I think that this confidence-building phase has only just started, and that we have to continue with confidence-building in the political field, including release of detainees, including delisting from the 1267 list, and then also in the humanitarian field, access for vaccination programs, food programs, and so on. And then I believe we have to move into the security field. And that's why I suggested a long time ago that we should try out if local ceasefires were doable. Could they be arranged for a specific period of time in the beginning, perhaps? It's very hard to arrange these kind of ceasefires in an asymmetric warfare. It's difficult enough in conventional warfare, but certainly in the situation we're in Afghanistan, it's much more difficult. But I believe it would be a useful test on the sincerity of the insurgency to come to the table for a dialogue. So it should be tested, should be tried as one among many steps towards a regular dialogue.
Afghanistan and the international community have a sovereignty agenda, also called the Kabul process. It's an agenda to ensure that security and governance is Afghan-led, Afghan-owned, and Afghan-driven. What can the international community do to ensure that that actually happens? How can you have the voices of Afghans and Afghan society included?
First of all, when it comes to development assistance, when I came in my mandate was an element related to aid coordination. And I was tasked to coordinate donor assistance. In my view, that is not the role of the international community. It has to be done by the Afghans. They have not only to lead, but be firmly in charge, because as we now soon start reducing our development assistance, they have to know how to do it themselves. We cannot say they're not mature enough. We have to make them mature enough to take that task. And then secondly, if we look at the military side, security side, certainly the build-up of their Afghan national security forces is very important, so that they also can take charge of their own security, and that is on its way. The third is within the field of discussions with the Taliban. I think it's tremendously important that this does not become a dialogue between the international community, or the United States, and the insurgency. That simply will not work. It can be one component, but not the most important component. Peace in Afghanistan cannot be made by the international community. It has to be made by the Afghans themselves. They have to decide how to organize themselves, how they see their future, how they make peace with each other. Nobody can substitute that role. So I hope that when we say we will Afghanize the process, we will give them responsibility, they will be in the lead, then we will actually do it also, because we have been talking about it for quite some time now. Let me just add to this that what I fear is, of course, that when we are in a hurry, then we don't have the time to give the Afghans the lead. Because, of course, processes will work more slowly in a way when the Afghans are in charge. They have to get used to it. We have to understand that even if we now see perhaps an end to the international military presence in Afghanistan, we must not be eager to lead ourselves, but we must do what we have promised, turn responsibility over to the Afghans.
On human rights, you outline the injustices and hardships that Afghanistan's women face and the continuing power and influence of warlords. You do conclude that the international community can have a lasting impact to ensure that human rights are protected and promoted. Could you talk about that a little bit, about how the international community can contribute to that?
Well, first of all, if we now move into a peace process, I think it's tremendously important that we in the international community stand firm on one principle. What has been achieved, for instance, through the Constitution, which gives girls and women equal rights, possibility to public life, take part in public life, possibilities for education, that we do our utmost to protect that. And then we can, of course, also, and you refer to civil society, we can support the civil society, strengthen it, enable it to have a real voice in the debate on political issues. That is tremendously important. We've done a lot, but we can do more. And then, finally, let's remember one thing. The main debate on human rights has to be between the Afghans themselves. I experienced very often when I try to engage in debates on human rights issues, that even women's networks said to me, be careful now, you are an unfaithful, and you must be careful so that you are not seen as somebody who do not have any legitimate role in this debate. So I would have preferred that we had more Muslims, for instance, in the UN mission, who could take part in that debate from the same perspective of being Muslims. For me, it was certainly a handicap that I could not do that to the fullest extent.
You conclude in your book that a peaceful resolution is possible. Looking ahead to 2014, it's a critical year. the withdrawal of most of the international forces, the election of the next president, and the likely shrinking of foreign assistance. What do you think are the critical steps for the Afghan government and the international community to take now to ensure a successful transition and to avoid the possibility of a return to civil war?
I think it's going to be a very difficult time that we have ahead of us. As I mentioned, I believe that a peace process of some sort is absolutely necessary. There are some first important steps that seem to be taken. That is promising, but we're only at the start of the process. I mentioned that the process has to be Afghan-led. That is crucial, I believe. And then there is another challenge that we must see to it, that there is a national consensus inside Afghanistan. Today, President Karzai faces opposition from even within his government, but in particular from representatives of the other ethnic groups. He has to be helped to build the national consensus that is required, and we must also take our role in that. We concentrate so often on President Karzai. We must also focus on all the others who can be spoilers in this kind of effort. So I believe that's important. Then we have, of course, the regional dimension. Afghanistan has Pakistan to its east, Iran to its west. Both have to be brought into the peace process in one way or another, so that their legitimate concerns are taken into account. That is not easy, in particular in a situation where the relationship between the US and Pakistan and Iran is more complex than it has been for quite some time. But it is absolutely critical.
Thank you very much. Thank you for joining the Global Observatory.